Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read, telling you we're really privileged tonight to be able to listen to an outstanding story by one of the most talented and accomplished writers in the Valley, Tehachapi author Valerie Schultz. The lead character in our story tonight turns out to be a Latin teacher, so it's no coincidence that the name of Valerie's story is Brevis, which in Latin means brevity. Here's Valerie Schultz to read Brevis.
Show me the way to go home. I'm tired and I want to go to bed. Show me the way to go home. I'm tired and I want to go to bed. I had a little drink about an hour ago and it's gone right to my head. Every word that I wrote over land or sea or foam, you can always hear me singing this song. Show me the way to go.
Brevis. My father has learned the F word. At least that's what I thought until his forceful and adroit usage of the word clued me in that he has probably been using it for years, just not in front of me. Can you tell me why you refused your treatments yesterday? Inquires the respiratory therapist sweetly. My father is supposed to be inhaling a smoky substance from a tube 4 times a day to help his lungs recover from the effects of his recent surgery. Too many damn effing people in and out of here all the time, replies my father. The serenity in her face briefly clouds. This is a Catholic hospital, and my father's language has probably made every attendant want to cover the ears of the Jesus who hangs on the cross on the wall across from my father's bed. He is a Germanic Jesus with blonde curls and blue eyes, but he is bloodied and looks like he knows he's in trouble. My father turns to me. "Where the F have you been?" he demands. I smile at the therapist, hoping my smile conveys, we all have our crosses. I went home to get your robe, like you asked, I say. My father has had cancer surgery. It unsettles me to think how much can happen in a few weeks. A routine test, an ominous diagnosis, a seemingly successful surgery. And my father has turned from a respectable mortgage broker into a patient who uses the F word with snarling originality in front of strangers. He has lost 2 feet of his colon and his manners. I am both glad and dismayed that all this has happened at the beginning of June, when I am on vacation from teaching and can deal with it. I have flown from Los Angeles to Chicago to spend time with my family, whom I usually visit only at Christmas time. I should state up front that in honor of the dynamics of our traditional family, my brother Mark went into the family business with my father because he was a boy, and I became a teacher because I was a girl. That's how things used to be done. My younger sister Polly, however, who was a menopausal surprise to my mother and probably helped drive her to an early grave, espoused feminism early on and stormed into our father's financial domain. It turns out Polly has the best head for figures and the hardest heart for management. She is the future of the company, even if my father insists on treating my brother, whose true fulfillment lies in building things, as the heir apparent to the mortgage throne. I should further come clean in that I not only teach, but I teach in a Catholic school. My final confession, I teach Latin, which makes my irrelevance to the world of my family completely clear. What matters is that I can be here at the hospital for hours on end while my siblings tend to business. I wait for doctors to have a moment to talk to me, and as they flip papers back and forth in a fat file in an attempt to remember who I am and what patient I represent, they remind me of my students desperately riffling through pages of verb conjugations before a test. I read thumbed-over magazines as my father sleeps. I eat in the hospital cafeteria, where the food is cheap and surprisingly not bad, and where I eavesdrop on conversations among medical people. The talk is lively and marbled with words I don't understand, although I can sometimes determine the root, hepaticus, of the liver, for example. I then call the cell phone numbers of my siblings and leave updates on my father's progress, which allows them to stay away with pure consciences. After all, they are needed at the office. Customers are waiting, lenders are wavering, employees are slacking, rates are fluctuating, there is paperwork, there are deadlines. They explain these things to me as though I am slow-witted. "Can you stay a few more days when Pete comes home?" Polly asks. This is another thing I feel awkward about and a bit left out. My sister calls our father Pete, which is his nickname from his salad days and is actually short for our last name, Peterson. She says this is less confusing at work, where everyone in the business refers to him as Pete. She also feels it is more professional not to refer to your boss as Daddy. Mark sometimes calls our father Sebastian, which is his given first name and which he hates, and which probably provides my brother's motivation. I alone persist in calling him Dad. A few more days. "I don't know," I say guardedly. I am not good with sick people, and I dread the idea of getting suckered into spending my whole summer as my father's nursemaid. "I'll pay to change your flight," Polly offers, more out of the need for her own convenience than out of charity, caritas, love. "I may have to teach summer school," I lie. I never teach summer school, but I hope my sister has not ever noticed this fact. "You never teach summer school," she says. I give her silent credit for her sharp powers of observation. "I'm full-time at the office and trying to plan a wedding." Polly is marrying a divorced vice president at one of their best lenders. The wedding is supposed to be over Labor Day weekend. My first impression after meeting her vice president once in the hospital waiting room, he is too old for her. He is the father of kids she probably could have gone to sleepovers with, for starters. "Let's play it by ear," I say. "Maybe Dad'll be fine on his own," I say, hopefully. But he won't be. The lead doctor, the stern oncologist, advises me that my father will have to have someone at home with him, because not only does he have cancer, his heart is weak and is not doing so well after the surgery. Next comes the cardiologist, who divulges that the heart is actually only pumping at 40% of its capacity, which is a cause for concern. And even I see that. My father's color is off, a bit gray, and he gets winded by even the slightest exertion. "Come on, Lizzie," he says, trying to be playful, using the childhood name that my coworkers would probably have a hard time imagining as referring to me. "Break me out of here." "When they say, Dad," I say. "Let's go home," he insists. "Pretty soon," I say. "Get me the F out of here," he says irritably. "Come on," he says again, only this time his voice sounds like he thinks I am failing him. "Come on, come on, let's go." The nurse from the main desk enters the cubicle, pulling the drape aside in a way that means business. "Mr. Peterson," she says firmly, opening the window curtains to let in a sliver of sun and hopefully some common sense. "For someone who wants to go home, you are not being very helpful in your treatment." Oh, for Christ's sake, says my father, and I glance again at the crucifix as though expecting a reaction, a raised eyebrow from the Lord. If you let me out of here, I'll do whatever you say at home. You can't smoke anymore, Dad. That's the main thing, I say. A man I once dated, a fellow teacher, big mistake, told me I have a bad habit of incorporating semicolons into speech. He looks at me impatiently. Yeah, yeah, he says. No more smokes. I am mindful of the way he emphatically did not quit smoking after his first heart attack years ago, in spite of the way my mother had harped on him to quit. You'd think a heart patient would be a little smarter, she'd say pointedly, each time he came in from the garage reeking of tobacco like the Marlboro Man. In response to which, he would only smile his most charming, if sheepish, grin. The doctors finally give in to my father's wishes, or to his health insurance limits, and allow him to go home. I am supposed to feed him, make sure he takes his many medications, ferry him to follow-up appointments with his many doctors, keep him from smoking, keep him from overestimating his strength, and keep him upbeat and comfortable. After that, I can find a vaccine for AIDS and negotiate peace in the Middle East. Oh, God, Lizzie, what would we be doing right now without you? Polly asks me, a rhetorical question that she is delighted not to have to answer. I have been home with my father for 3 weeks post-surgery, and as he would say, it has been no effing picnic. She has come by after work with the monthly P&L statements. Profit and loss, Polly explains helpfully, as though to someone who is a foreigner in her country, along with 6 cardboard tubs of greasy Chinese takeout, which is not on our father's approved diet. You're not helping, I say to her, showing her the restrictive list of foods I was given just today. Hell with it, my dad says, negotiating with difficulty a forkful of barbecued pork. It's making me feel hungry for once. He winks. Chinese, he says. I'll be hungry again in an hour. He has to take a breath, mid-sentence. I have noticed, of course, that my father has had no appetite, that he eats more like a bird than a grown man. His fingers, in fact, are beginning to look bird-like to me, bony, frail, and distressingly weak. You gotta eat, Pete, Polly says, and then, almost apologetically to me, he's gotta eat. He's on a specific diet, I say. It's new. It's a kidney diet. I usually try not to talk about my father as though he either isn't there or is too far gone to understand grown-up talk, but the kidney thing has me worried. I'm not sure if Polly understands that the reason our father is now on dialysis twice a week is because his kidneys have, in fact, quit working. He is in renal failure, which apparently can happen after major surgery. Rene, kidney, renal failure, freaked out daughter. I drive him to his dialysis appointments and then come home. During these free hours, I busy myself washing my father's sheets and pajamas or researching his complications online. For the first dialysis treatment, I brought a book with me and settled in the waiting room, not realizing that the process takes 3 or 4 hours to complete. I sat and watched the parade of dialysis recipients, going in, going out, a revolving door schedule that will not vary for the rest of these people's lives, and I felt depressed by the traffic. Some of the patients were so weak, unable to walk, listless, debilitated, and I pictured my loud and once virile father becoming one of them. I don't like where he's headed. Now I just pull up to the dialysis center. I run in and summon a strapping young man who greets my father and helps me load him into the wheelchair, which then carries him to his date with the complex machine that will extract his blood, separate it, filter it, purify it, and then siphon it back in. Then I go back and fetch him. When he's finished, he's always cold. Dialysis is a miraculous invention, to my mind a manifestation of God and science working together. It keeps my father alive, but he hates going there. He complains loudly that it's cold, it's boring, the TV channels don't show the damn Bears games. Of course, when I asked the attendant if he could watch the game, he looked at me oddly and then explained, clearly embarrassed both by my father's disorientation in time and my lack of fandom, that it is not football season. My father is also furious with the nephrologist on duty today who gave me the dietary guidelines. He suggested upping his treatments to 3 times a week. Forget it, he said to the doctor. I'd rather be dead than here another day. I try to engage my sister and brother in our father's multiplying medical issues, but they get a glazed look when I start to explain that one medication is canceling out another's effectiveness and that one doctor prescribes things that are contraindicated by the other doctors and that the puzzle of our father's health is beginning to seem unsolvable. He's an elderly cancer patient with an overworked heart, useless kidneys, unhealthy habits, and a bad attitude. There's more. The random pills that my father looks at and then says to me, yeah, I don't want to take that. And he won't. Do you even know what that one is for? I ask in frustration. Nah, he says. I don't need that one. F it. He won't budge. Sic semper tyrannis. He is a patient from hell, and I am no Florence Nightingale. At the moment, however, Polly is more interested in getting our father's signature on some documents. Stuff he was supposed to sign, she says tightly, when I ask, dismissing my interest. Mark has been more concerned with the business implications of the incapacity or death of a corporation's owner than with our father's health complications. I know he has to worry about the details, but the talk of licenses and legalities still gets on my nerves. Besides, Mark is trying to reason with a man who lately mentioned to Polly that a certain property in a deal she was having issues with must have cost $100 or so. The numbers just don't make sense to him anymore. What needs to make sense in my father's world right now is the proper prescription of medications, the magical arrangements of effective treatments. Failing those, maybe a line on the elusive, fabled fountain of youth. Our father's time is growing short. I feel ridiculously dramatic even thinking that, let alone saying that, to my ostrich-like siblings. Yet I don't think I'll be coming home to see him this Christmas. I think of that sad song, I'll be home for Christmas. And I feel like crying, as I often do. As much as I want to go home, back to my familiar, comfortable, ordered existence, where I am in charge, I'm realizing that this is it. I'm pretty sure that another Christmas with my father, my healthy father, not this strangely shrinking stranger, with his overly generous gifts and overly strong eggnog and overwhelmingly enveloping hugs, will be only in my dreams. That's the part that makes me cry.
Baby, I'll be home for Christmas, but only in my dreams.
A few more weeks oppress us. The 4th of July comes and goes. July here is hot and sticky and mosquito-y. I wonder if anyone in Los Angeles misses me, besides the co-worker whom I asked to water my plants and take in my mail. I call her once a week to ask her to hold down my small fort for a little longer. I worry that I am asking too much, but she assures me warmly, more warmly than I deserve, that it's not a problem. I have no pets. My sprinklers are on a timer. My paycheck is deposited and my rent is paid automatically from my bank account. My only loose end is an overdue library book. I have an easy life to get away from, uncomplicated, generic even, and I feel a nagging concern about that. Polly asks me if there is a special someone who might like to come stay with me. She's sniffing for sex or romance in my life, but there is no scent for her to pick up. "Who's this guy?" my father asks. "This is Andrew, Dad," I say, by way of introduction. "He's here to give us a hand, you know, with things." Things like the fact that I am not strong enough to lift my father off the floor where he landed last night when he decided to get up and go to the bathroom without calling me for help. Or that I am not brave enough to clean him up after he does go to the bathroom. Or that I am not willing enough to follow his too-thin, paper-skinned, atrophied body into the shower and give him a good, much-needed scrub. Or that I am so sleep-deprived that I frazzle as easily as a woman pregnant with triplets. "Oh, God, Lizzie, don't tell me," said Mark at 3 a.m. when I called him. The sound of me in tears made him think our father had died. "You need to come over," I said, between jagged gulps of air and with quivering lips. "I can't lift him off the floor." Which is why, in the light of morning, Mark has arranged for Andrew. Andrew is a gentle giant, a quiet Filipino who towers over me and who can lift my father as easily as if repositioning a mannequin. Andrew is a home health aide. My brother has explained, rather unnervingly, that Andrew's services include pretty much anything I ask him to do. Right now, Andrew is preparing my father for an overdue shower. "I'm going to leave you two to get to know each other," I say, heading for the bedroom door, but not before I hear my father say to Andrew, "So, how the hell much am I paying you?" Andrew is a godsend, an angel from heaven, although he is a rather expensive gift from above. He is, of course, not covered by Medicare or by my father's supplemental insurance, and so I know that as a caregiver, I am privileged beyond measure. How can I complain about my stressful lot in life when Andrew bathes, dresses, medicates, and humors my father? He accompanies my father to the dialysis center and stays with him. He sleeps in my father's room and awakens at my father's slightest murmur. "I can cook, clean, do laundry," he tells me. "But those are the things I am glad to do." I notice that Andrew wears a wedding ring, and I ask about his wife, her name, her whereabouts, and whether or not she resents his all-consuming hours. "She is a home health aide too," he says, "but for women." Andrew and his wife have been married for 10 years but have yet to produce a child. I assume this is why I find him saying a rosary every night when I go into my father's room to say goodnight. Andrew and his wife are faithful Catholics who have never used birth control, yet they are childless. They came to work in America, he tells me, in order to save money for in vitro fertilization. They have promised God that they will call their first son John Paul for the second pope of that name. In vitro. Within the glass. I don't have the heart to tell him that, according to church teaching, the procedure he and his wife have pinned their hopes on to start a family is considered a sin. Instead, I smile encouragingly. Andrew seems like he'd be an awfully good dad. The hallucinations start when Andrew takes off for the weekend and the relief pitcher, another Filipino named Philip, which makes me wonder, are all Filipino home health aides named for apostles, takes over. Philip costs more because it is the weekend, and his manner with my father is less effective. Philip's style is less sure. He waits for my father to ask for help rather than anticipating trouble, which irritates my father. "Where's Edgar?" he demands, calling Andrew the wrong name, as is his custom. When I was a child, my father called everyone Chief, which I later understood meant that he didn't remember the fellow's name. "Andrew has the weekend off," I say. "This is Philip." "Oh, for Christ's sake," my father says. The first night on Philip's watch, my father starts out muttering in a low voice, and Philip doesn't wake up. I hear talking, and as I creep to the door of my father's bedroom, it sounds like my father is on the phone. It's midnight. "Yeah, yeah," my father says, and then pauses, listening to the unseen caller, or one called, I'm not sure which. "Yeah," he says again. "I get the front side points, I get it. But what about the backside points?" I recognize the lingo of mortgage speak. My father's voice is getting louder, and I wonder who is talking business with him at this hour, or ever, for that matter, since he no longer computes. But when I go into the room, my father is lying in bed, sound asleep, and yet sounding agitated as he's going over figures. 8.5, 9.5, 30-year fixed. What the hell is that? He pauses. "What the F are you talking about?" he bellows, and Philip jumps awake. He looks at my father, then at me, and I can see that he is deeply ashamed to have been caught asleep on the job. "It's fine," I whisper. "He's talking in his sleep." But the talking in his sleep doesn't stop, even after Andrew is back from his presumably procreative weekend with his wife. My father is confused when he is awake, mistaking day for night, talking about selling his car to the rag man, talking about my mother's pot of tea being ready. Stark, crazy stuff. One night I hear him ask Andrew for a pair of scissors. "Why do you need scissors, Mr. Pete?" asks Andrew. "So I can kill Al," my father answers calmly, his dead brother's name. "Let's wait until morning, Mr. Pete," says Andrew, just as calmly. And I again thank God for Andrew, for home health aides, and for my father's disposable income that makes Andrew possible. My father now jabbers all night long, imaginary phone calls, one-sided conversations, and songs. He has always loved to sing, but he's never had a knack for remembering lyrics. But no matter, he sings show tunes mostly, and a little Sinatra. My nights are interspersed with King Arthur's songs from Camelot and Fly Me to the Moon. In the dead of night, as I rest on a mattress in the room next to where my father frets and tosses, he sings in his waking sleep. Show me the way to go home. I'm tired and I want to go to bed. He sings in a sweet, slow monotone. Twice, three times, four times. It sounds like a prayer. This morning, a dried-on splash of coffee on the kitchen table makes me remember my father on my sixth birthday. I can feel him sitting next to me at my little table, his trousered legs all bunched up underneath, pouring milky coffee from his big mug into my doll-sized china teacup, and drinking with me in all seriousness, taking his time, even though he had to get to work, listening to me with grown-up respect. Now I watch him, his look of amazement that his hand is too weak even to bring the coffee cup to his lips. His lack of strength makes him not want the coffee, because he certainly doesn't want my help. He spills more coffee than he drinks. He's not supposed to have coffee anyway. I know this, but I still make him a cup whenever he asks for one, light on the coffee, heavy on the milk. I'm as bad as Polly now, giving him whatever he wants. At least it's something in his stomach. My father has always been the alpha male. To be so dependent is impossibly hard for him. He is unhappy, in pain, depressed, and basically over it. He's also impatient. He thought dying would be faster. A heart attack. Bam, he says. He had certain expectations. And he's not so sure about God. Don't even know if I believe in God, he says. We're having a rare, lucid moment over coffee. He smiles apologetically, but I sense he is also challenging me to contradict him, to convince him that he's wrong, like I used to. Well, Dad, God believes in you, I say, a line I have used with students, and which now sounds idiotic. Maybe 6 feet under is 6 feet under, he says. And I realize that I don't even know if he wants to be buried or cremated, if he wants a mass or a simple service, if there are even special songs he'd like sung at his funeral. In the face of doubting the existence of God, these seem like trivial matters. My father fumbles with something in his pocket. What's in your pocket? I ask, relieved to avoid the heavier questions I should ask him. He hands me something off-white that looks familiar, but I can't place it for a minute. My teeth, he says. It's a bridge, and now I see that his lower mouth looks sunken like a cadaver's, cadere to fall. My teeth fell out, he says. I'll be goddamned. So, what do you like best about teaching? It must be very rewarding, Polly says to me, out of the blue. Polly is trying hard to draw me out by asking things like this, while she is simultaneously adding and crossing people off the guest list for her wedding, browsing online for bridesmaid dresses, and then deciding to call the whole thing off, or not. Her lukewarm vice president hasn't been around for a couple of weeks. I appreciate her efforts, but I want to tell her that she can drop the Katie Couric act. If I had a nickel for every time someone asked me about the rewards of teaching, I'd have a nickel for just about every conversation I've had with a stranger for the past 15 years. 15 years. I'm not sure if this is what I actually meant to do. You can't really tell the people who are looking at you like you're a cross between a saint and a madwoman that you think of teaching pretty much as your job. That there's really no more nobility in getting up and going to work in a classroom than in a diner or a mortgage company. I am well compensated for what I do. I used to think the most important thing for me to accomplish was to produce young minds that could think fluently in Latin. After a few years, I scaled back my ambition to cramming my students' heads full of enough Latin to get them into a decent university. Every now and then, I have a kid who loves language as much as I do. Actually, there have been three. Lately, I suspect that my most meaningful work is to treat my students like human beings, to look in their eyes with the same respect I'd give anybody else, a coworker, or even a stranger, and just to be still and listen. which is harder than it sounds, but probably more fulfilling than any other part of my educational duties. Instead, I offer my standard line. I like the kids. Yikes, Polly says. Better you than me. Why has it always been so important to me to be completely different from my siblings, from my family? There are no teachers in my family. There's only a handful of college graduates. The Petersons don't consider leaving the Chicago area. I moved to California in search of my magnum opus. As Charlotte tells Wilbur at the end of the story of her web, a clip of an animated movie I show my Latin students every year for fun. There was some great work that I felt called to, and yet I still don't know what it was or is. I know the family I left behind thinks I have gone out of my way to be weird, and in my heart of hearts, I concur. Charlotte's magnum opus is her sack of eggs, and it occurs to me that the three of us must be our father's magnum opus. He must see us as the end of his bloodline, as failing to carry his DNA into the future. One of us had better hurry up and have kids. But who? Polly with her faltering vice president and her ambition? Mark, whose sexual orientation is an open secret we don't discuss? Me, with a better statistical chance of being taken hostage by terrorists than being married, or whatever that sensational news story said years ago? It's not the first time the long-legged idea of artificial insemination strolls through my brain. Seminous seed, how things begin. Tell me about Mom, Polly says. It is Friday evening, and she is spending the night with me, an unusual pause in her jam-packed schedule. What do you remember? I ask. I was 5 when she died, Polly says. I mostly remember how tall she was. Was she? I ask. I don't remember her height as remarkable. Then again, I wasn't 5 the last time I saw her. I remember how she smelled like her perfume with the tassel on the bottle, Polly says. And I remember spilling my milk all over the place and Mom saying, "My carpet, my carpet." So I've always thought that if I ever have kids, I won't have any carpet for them to feel bad about messing up, only wood floors. The non-profound things we remember. I remember how she liked to sing, Polly says. They both did, I say. They were always breaking into some corny song. Somebody asked me once if my parents had ever been in show business. Polly laughs, then darkening. I remember I had to stay with the Finsters instead of going to her funeral. I guess that was a mistake, I say. You probably would have been better off to be there with everybody, to know what was going on. I'd been away at college, a smart sophomore at Marquette, a language major, when my father had called to tell me about my mother. A brain aneurysm, went to bed and never woke up, 47 years old. Only 10 years older than I am now, I realize. A tragedy. It was also ironic that my chain-smoking, type 1 workaholic father hadn't gone first. That had been the accepted prediction. Dad tried to read a speech at her funeral, the one where Macbeth finds out about Lady Macbeth. She should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word, I say. But he choked up. Mark tried to finish it, but I thought he'd never, ever stop crying. I'd actually been relieved when neither had gotten to the part about life being a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. My mother would not have agreed with that. She'd always had a sense of the eternal. On her tombstone, rarely visited, my father'd had them carve out, out, brief candle. You think he wants Shakespeare? Polly asked. It's the first time she has acknowledged that our father is dying. You ask him, Lizzie. He'll talk about stuff like that to you. He'll talk to you, too, I say. But we both know that his ability to converse about anything cogently is hit or miss, fleeting, brevis, a brief candle, no matter how old the dying person is. I've been living in my father's house since June, but as though nearing the end of his final summer break himself, my father, in the long decline of congestive heart failure, decides to quit dialysis as August bakes us crisp. The nephrologist explains carefully, neutrally, to him that this means he will die sooner rather than later, and my father nods with all the strength he has left. Been waiting for that heart attack, my father tells his doctor. Bam, gone, that's what I wanted, he finishes, out of breath. Then he smiles, a ghostly approximation of his old grin. Sometimes it's not that easy, says his doctor, in a voice of deep respect that I could kiss him for. At last, someone is talking to my father as though he is a human being rather than a list of symptoms. The nephrologist gives me the phone number for the hospice people who will make my father's last several days comfortable. I make the call. It's impossible. It's unbelievable. Our father looks toward the bedroom window, past Polly, past Mark, past me. What is Daddy? Polly asks. She has dropped all pretense of his being Pete, her boss, and is his little girl again. She has broken off her engagement to the vice president. She's been crying, but is trying to speak lightly. They're all around me. His voice trails off and he is sound asleep. Then his brittle body jolts, as though something is rudely waking him. Who is? Asks Mark. Who's all around him? He looks at me with alarm. Does Mark think I know the answer? Mark has been hanging back, as though our father has something contagious. But I try to forgive him for being a generally awkward son. My father suddenly looks right at me with unsettling clarity. It's scaring the crap out of me, he says in his regular voice. You're doing fine, I say to him. What am I doing? He asks. He sounds nervous. You're doing what you need to do, I say, feeling inadequate. In my broken heart, I ask God to show him the way to go home.
Show me the way to go home. I'm tired and I wanna go to bed. I had a little drink about an hour ago, and it's gone right to my head. Every word that I roam over land or sea or foam, you can always hear me singing this song. Show me.
We have no big goodbyes, no dramatic words of farewell, no tender parting. We just sit with him and chat a little amongst ourselves. The little cavern in his mouth where his bridge used to be looks infected. He keeps trying to touch it and says it hurts a lot. That's when Andrew starts the morphine. By midnight, he is asleep and tranquil. He seems to be in no pain. Polly and Mark retreat to their respective apartments for clothes, for space, for balance, promising to return early the next day. He never really wakes up again. In the end, in the pale morning light, my father breathes out and then doesn't breathe in. He just doesn't, although I wait for it for a long time. It just doesn't come, that small expansion of chest. And as he liked to say, that's all she wrote. In death, my father looks smoother, younger, untroubled by those last indignities. And I hope whatever was there all around him is no longer scaring the crap out of him. I've never been alone with a dead body before. There are no open eyes to close, like in the movies. No drama of a swoon on my part. Just no more breaths. There are birds, then an early lawnmower beyond the window. But my father's room is perfectly quiet. He's there, but he's gone. The only breath that resumes is mine. I know that I should summon Andrew, call my brother and sister, note the time of death for the hospice paperwork, alert the funeral home, but I do nothing. The weeks I thought would never end, the broiling summer days of this annus horribilis have ended. I want to run from this room and never leave this room. I'm free to go, but I'm afraid to move. I'm afraid that there may actually be nothing waiting for me. I kiss my dad on his cheek. Then I cry like the overgrown orphan that I am.
Yes, I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day. In everything that's light and gay, I'll always think of you that way. I will find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you. Yes, I will dig you in the early bright, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon. I'll be looking, but I'll be seeing you.
That was Valerie Schultz reading Brevis. Valerie always presents us with an extremely well-written story, this time about a dying father, his son, and two daughters. The father is an outspoken mortgage broker who's always very blunt and direct, doesn't mind using a few cuss words now and then either, while the younger daughter, Polly, and the son, Mark, always seem to be preoccupied with business affairs. Liz, the other daughter, the Latin teacher, who is the point-of-view character, tries her best to deal with her father's multiple illnesses. She patiently administers to him in his bouts with cancer, heart trouble, and kidney failure. She's always positive, patient, and friendly, and as his health deteriorates further, witnesses him going from bad to worse and finally passing away. No, it wasn't a very happy ending type story, but the reality is that it's the same type of story that sooner or later many of us might have to face. Thank you, Valerie Schultz, for such a well-written narrative. I'm not quite sure how to say thanks in Latin, but I suspect it's something like multas gratias. Friends, as we mentioned earlier, Valerie Schultz has probably been on our show for at least 15 out of the 20 years that we've been on the air. Somehow our stories seem to get better and better as the years go by. Valerie has been published many times. She writes a column for the Bakersfield Californian. Originally, she graduated as a drama major from the University of Texas. Of course, we hope she has more stories for us in years to come. And so we come to the close of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read stories again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Jim Benelli. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.